You're listening to Talk the Walk, the podcast putting legs on social work in Indigenous communities through story. From Darwin, Australia, this is your host, Lucy Van Sambeek. Hello, and welcome back to Talk the Walk. My guest today is Talia Dram Butler, a Dhurrumbul woman who lives in Kuranda in far north Queensland. Over her 15-year career, Talia has contributed to the development of Aboriginal understandings and methodologies of practice in the fields of community development, rights and justice, health, social and emotional well-being, and therapy. Talia has worked in a range of programs in Cairns and Cape York, including developing and delivering the Drop the Rock program, building the capacity of Aboriginal communities in mental health service delivery. Talia is currently employed as a senior social worker in the emergency department and intensive care units at Cairns Hospital. In 2014, she completed the Masters in Narrative Therapy and Community Work. Talia is a co-author of Aboriginal Narrative Practice, Honouring Storylines of Pride, Strength and Creativity, where she writes about the many ways she's developing and using narrative practices that resonate for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. Talia is also on the International Teaching Faculty of the Dulwich Centre for Narrative Therapy. Thank you, Talia, for joining me on Talk the Walk today. It's so great to have you.
Thanks, Lucy. It's exciting to be here.
As someone who's also passionate about narrative therapy and how that may support Aboriginal people to tell their stories in ways that promote healing in their lives, I'm really excited to have the opportunity to talk with you today. And I'm wondering if we can start with some of the ideas that you've written and presented about on the idea of narrative therapy as a decolonizing practice. Can you share some of your findings through your work and your research that's led you to embrace narrative therapy and what it is that makes it a decolonizing practice?
Yeah, and I think that's a lovely place to start, because I think that the questions that narrative therapy invites us to ask people offers a particular telling of a story. And, you know, you'll be familiar with the sentiment that the problem is the problem, that the person, the community, or the family are not the problem. And in my work, I think that when I ask questions, particularly that, for example, externalize the problem, people are able to position themselves in a way that allows for agency and allows them to kind of look at the problem from a bit of a distance, to talk about the effects of it and where it came from, the history of the problem, and then, you know, talk about the many ways that they're already responding to the problem, or that their family are supporting them, or their ancestors have supported them in the past to respond to such problems. And I think that it's a really practical, sensible way of asking questions. And, you know, in my work, I've definitely found that people love answering these questions. They love telling the stories of their lives and particularly how they live out their strong story, even in the face of problems.
So could you give us a bit of an idea of the work that you have done or the research that you've found through your studies, the things that really resonate for people and the kind of practices that really connect with Aboriginal people and how you're using them?
Yeah, you know, definitely thinking about the various parts of my work. So in the emergency department, for example, you know, people are generally in crises. And I guess, like, one of the things too is that it really holds me to a framework where I'm not going in just fumbling over, you know, trying to be an active listener, I guess, which is what I probably learned in my early training. I go in with a framework of, I suppose, ways that things, questions that I can offer that with always the intention of bringing out that strong story. So I think definitely in when people are experiencing a crisis of whatever sort, narrative practice gives us an invitation to a particular story.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we bring forward that story, the crisis becomes, I guess, the backstory, and we're starting to talk more about responses to what's going on, or different skills and knowledge that individuals or their families have that might be useful in responding to the crisis. So I guess there's that part. And then certainly in my work in the intensive care unit, which of course involves, you know, a lot of grief and loss and you know, working with families when they're seeing off their loved ones who are dying, you know, remembering conversations, I guess it can be pretty nerving to be around, you know, to be with people at what is often that hardest time. So when, for example, treatment is being withdrawn and there's a, you know, decision to let people die, there's a, of course, a range of emotions that come with that. And using the remembering conversations in that setting, it is so wonderful, the stories that I get told by people about their loved ones and family members. It's, you know, that's keeps me going.
So for those that aren't familiar with how remembering conversations work, can you talk us through that?
Yeah, so Michael White talked about the saying hello again metaphor, which, you know, I guess a lot of practice is around saying your final goodbye, and particularly from a social work perspective, the role is often around that practical support that goes with saying goodbye. Whereas I think there's an opportunity with remembering practices, with that idea that we're, the person is dying, the person might be leaving us, but the relationship and the person's stories stay with us forever. Mm-hmm. And those stories continue to shape the way we live out our lives. You know, thinking for ourselves, decisions that I make in my life, whether that's around, you know, my own family or my work, I'm always thinking about my ancestors in that. So, and, you know, different family members that are with me or that are not with me. So I think it's a, you know, a different way of talking about people that is able to, you know, really hold on to that story and honour them in a way that, you know, really shows that that story will continue to shape our lives.
Mm. And so these conversations, are they taking place with the whole family, including the person that is dying, or is it just with individuals? How is it working?
Usually not, because in the intensive care unit, often people are intubated and are not able to talk. But I guess, you know, not completely. They're not completely left out of it, because I ask lots of questions about who they are and how they live their life and what drove them to live their lives in particular ways. And so they're brought into the space through those stories. And, you know, it never kind of ceases to amaze me how often I laugh with families, even in those sad times, because people always have, you know, alongside the really tough stories and the stories about the day-to-day, there's always these funny stories that people like to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, in that, my role is always about asking questions about that.
Can you speak about some of the other practices you might use in the hospital setting? Because like you said before, it's a crisis kind of environment. And I imagine that's quite tricky in some ways, to have lengthy conversations when there's so much happening around you and perhaps a sense of crisis about people. So what have been some of the other tools, I guess, particularly with Aboriginal people, that have been helpful in that environment?
Certainly I'm always aware of my therapeutic posture, and I'm aware that, you know, the person in front of me is the expert on their life. But I guess, like you say, time is often limited. And so I have to be quite influential as well about some of the questions that I ask. So, you know, how I do that, particularly with Aboriginal people and Torres Strait Islander people, is, you know, I know that there is a strong story in culture, And there's a strong story that goes back through our families, and people are always happy to be talking about the strong story of their family and their culture. And so that's one of the practices, that those remembering conversations, even in crisis, is just drawing on the skills and knowledge of that person, but knowing that their story is their family's story, their community's story, and their, you know, the story that goes back through millennia. So again, I get so enriched hearing these stories, but, you know, so even if I'm externalizing the problem or, you know, having reauthoring conversations, I'm very aware that we exist as part of our family, as part of our community over time. So, you know, I get to hear the stories of lots of people, which is just lovely.
What is it that you bring as a Turrbal woman to the practice that perhaps a non-Indigenous person like myself, who uses the same kind of therapeutic approach, what impact does your cultural background have on the way you practice?
I guess I'm able to, because I have that insider knowledge, you know, the experience of the stories, for example, you know, the hard stories, the stories of the politics of it all, the stories of stolen generation, you know, of dispossession from country and those kind of stories. I have that experience as well. So I think firstly, there's an understanding that I know and you know. You know, that, when I ask questions, there's an understanding that I'm coming from a particular place. And like I said, because, you know, we do the Aboriginal mapping, that's how the conversation starts. You know, who's your mob, who's my mob, we find how we're related kind of thing. And I think that sets, I don't know, it maybe gives me a particular, I don't want to say permission, but a particular position that I start the conversation from, which probably includes this understanding that, well, you know what I mean about this, you know. That's not to say that non-Indigenous people don't know what they mean about that, but there's an understanding that we both know.
Yes.
Makes sense.
I'm glad you mentioned the political aspect of our practice, and I wanted to ask you about that too. In preparing for this interview, I read a little piece that you'd written on our practice being political. And I'm imagining that looking through an Aboriginal lens, this is such an important concept, because many of the issues our clients face can be reframed from something diagnostic and internalizing to wider systemic social justice issues. And I loved when I read a particular line where you described a client not struggling with depression, but struggling with oppression. Can you speak about your understanding of social work practice as a political practice?
I think that every aspect of our practice is political. You know, the personal is the political and the professional is the political. I think that, you know, people's stories always exist in a broader context, including our own. And there's no structure that, I mean, even the practice of diagnosing from a biomedical model, how that's done, I guess the history of biomedicine, and in particular the history with Aboriginal people and the history with women, I guess it can render invisible the stories of injustice. And, you know, often people are living their lives in ways that are responding to various forms of injustice, and whether that's, you know, this is just one example off the top of my head, you know, that if people are experiencing unemployment, for example, the unemployment exists because of often racism in structures such as education, such as, you know, people being not receiving appropriate education in childhood and high school years, and then that translating as they get older, and poverty is a political issue. So I think that people's stories always exist within a context that is systemic. And I think it's necessary that we work at the coalface, but it also needs to be looked at systemically.
I know that Indigenous health, wellbeing and justice is an area of work that you are really passionate about. And I'm wondering, how are we doing in terms of attracting Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people to these career pathways? And was there anything, I guess, that assisted you in being able to take the direction that you have taken in your career?
How are we doing? There's always these wonderful stories of success. I'm a member of Indigenous Allied Health Australia, or IHA, which is a fantastic organisation that, you know, supports and celebrates and, I guess, just continues to encourage us to strive for excellence in that professional setting. And so if I was sitting with the IHA mob today, I would say we are just doing bloody fantastically. But then there is also a long way to go. And, you know, just as an example of that, in remote communities, and no doubt this would be familiar to you as well in Northern Territory, but certainly in Queensland, it's still predominantly fly-in, fly-out services. Mm. When the community absolutely have the answers and the capacity to, you know, make the change. So I guess I probably think that we should be putting more effort into, you know, telling young people that it's possible to have these careers for a start, and then for, you know, for example, university systems to be working harder to make it more possible in the face of all the other complexities of life that Aboriginal people experience. So an example of that is that the University of Melbourne have created a special pathway for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who have worked in the field for many years, often without university degrees. So there's a pathway for them to get into the Masters of Narrative Therapy and Community Work. Mm-hmm. And then that's a stepping stone to, you know, there's three people this year who are undertaking a PhD from that. There are these possibilities out there. Mm. I also see in many places there can be a bit of a concentration of workers where a qualification is not necessary. So, for example, liaison officers, they have such a wealth of knowledge on culture and being able to do the cultural brokerage. And then, you know, we should be putting in more effort to say what else is going to get you there, because we also have the capacity to be doctors and surgeons and everything else that we are being. But the system needs to support that and encourage that.
And so in terms of the social work profession, what do you see the AASW, for instance, doing in order to attract more Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples to the social work profession?
Yeah, I think that it's certainly very positive that the Code of Ethics, it's located very well in saying that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are Aboriginal people are the First Nations of this land. Torres Strait Islander people are the First Nations people of the Torres Strait Islands. And throughout the Code of Ethics, in all the various areas, it locates it as that. So I think that that's certainly an important part. I wonder about the accountability of that and the accountability that non-Aboriginal social workers have to that, and how, you know, how can we make sure that, you know, yeah, these principles that are written in our Code of Ethics, in the very document that guides us on our practice and tells us what it's all about, how do we make sure we're being accountable to that?
And I know that you've been through the mental health accreditation with the AASW as well. How easy was that process for you, given it's quite, well, I've had a look at it myself, and I kind of got a bit turned off thinking, you know, the way I practice, I'm not sure that I'm going to get through this process. So I know that they recognise narrative therapy as an approach for working with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. However, they also recognise a whole lot of other approaches, which many of the questions they ask have to fit into their way of assessing people. And I just wondered, how did you go through that process?
I definitely agree with you. I think this is like many job applications that we do. I think, we have to maybe put our passion aside and answer the question in a way that we pass or something. Yeah, and I think just the whole setup with the Medicare, how it pans out once you do get accredited is really difficult if you're working with Aboriginal communities, because there's a set number of sessions, and it can be really difficult for people who are living with hardship to get to appointments, for example, but you have to kind of set it up that way. So I think that's a good example of an area that the AASW could be looking at to make more specific to Aboriginal people and communities.
Yeah, I'd be in favour of that too. I'm wondering if we can take a different direction now. And following on from talking about your passion, which is Indigenous health, wellbeing and justice, I'm wondering if you can take us back to a time in your life when perhaps this passion was just a little spark. And what do you think it was that led you down this pathway, I guess, in life and in work?
I was lucky enough to grow up in a very political family, and that's all corners of my family. People have asked me this question, what led you to be a social worker? And I just kind of think, well, actually, I think it was always going to happen. I can't sort of think of a time other than when I enrolled in the course that I kind of thought, oh, yeah, that's what I want to do. I never necessarily did that. But I think has always been a strive for justice that has been passed down through the generations, including from my Irish grandmother as well as my Aboriginal family. So, I think that it's that constant striving for social justice and the necessity of doing that. I as much as sometimes I think it would be really nice to run a cafe or something, run through my head a couple of times, but I think it's a part of who I am.
And I'm sure there are some values or beliefs or principles that, you've carried through your life. I mean, obviously the strive for justice is one of those values and principles that's important to you. What else is there?
I think hope is a really important thing, because if we didn't continue to hope and believe that justice is possible, we wouldn't bother. So I definitely think that hope has and belief has been an important part of that. It's a good question, Lucy. I definitely think just that constant striving for justice, because, I guess that's what, just to go back to your earlier question about the personal and the professional being political, I think that if we're not constantly working towards justice for people, then we're just, this is for me personally, and this is not a kind of complaint against anyone, but you can just get paid as well. I think it's important that we earn our money and, have the difficult conversations. Sometimes that means putting yourself and, your job on the line, stepping out of your comfort zone is really important in that. So, I think that they're the kind of things that keep me going on that path.
And you mentioned family being really important to you and an Irish grandmother. I'm keen to hear that story. Perhaps that might come out with this question. But are there any particular people that have influenced you in the development of these values and principles, the strive for justice, hope that change is possible? Who are the people that you've looked up to or have been role models for you?
Yeah, I mean, I'm from a big family, so I won't list everyone, but for any family that are listening, everyone. In particular, though, my parents have definitely made it possible I've had the privilege of education, which, you know, my parents certainly worked very hard for me to have that and, you know, continue to kind of push me and believe in me. My parents and my brothers, that is. You know, particularly my grandmothers and all of them. So including, you know, going back to my great-grandparents, and I was certainly lucky and blessed to have known my great-grandmother. She used to, Nana Eddie Meredith, she used to sing to us in language, and, you know, I wish I knew that language, but I feel really blessed to have been sung to in language, and I remember the moments. So grandmothers, just from the many parts of who I am, have really, you know, paved the way for me.
And please tell us the story about the Irish grandmother and the influence she's had on you.
Yeah, well, and certainly, you know, a continuing influence with my Irish mother. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she was a radical. She used to talk on soapbox in Sydney, and, you know, back in those days, as a woman, a single woman, that was fairly rare. I've got this beautiful photo of my Irish grandmother and my Aboriginal grandmother, and, you know, one was drinking a shandy and one was drinking a bourbon or something, and they were laughing together. And I guess I've been really lucky to have that in my life, where when I say my family, I mean, certainly family gatherings are my whole family and all the parts of who I am. And I've never had to, I guess, separate them, which I know that I'm blessed to have had that opportunity. And my Irish grandmother used to write to the paper about how proud she was about her Aboriginal grandkids, and was always talking about justice. And I remember a quote from a movie that the Irish are the blacks of Europe. So growing up saying, well, you know, I've kind of got a good part of both sides, because there's certainly the fight there, there's a fire in my belly from all parts of who I am, which is, I think, a good combination.
Yeah. So if your grandmothers were here listening to this conversation now, what would they tell me about the ways that justice has showed up in your life?
You know, it's through their constant holding to that, to justice, that I've had the privilege of education. So I think that would be, you know, the first way that they've seen their struggles, you know, and not just me, my generation, I guess. We've all made it in the world in a really profound way, which we always link back to our family and the people gone before us. I guess, like I say, that continuing fire in my belly that doesn't go out, that keeps me, holds me to the principles of justice doing, and, you know, holds me to advocating when I need to and speaking up when I need to, you know, and not just being, I guess, comfortable in my job and comfortable in having a career. And like, it's definitely an opportunity, but it's also an obligation and a responsibility. So I think that they would see that as having done justice.
Mm. So what do you think's been some of the more difficult challenges or struggles that you've faced along the way in your career?
Definitely racism. I mean, I could tell stories of specific challenges and struggles, but I think that it all comes back to racism, and, you know, and systemic racism in particular, you know, including where I've not had opportunities, or, you know, I suppose where I've been with families that, you know, during really tough times, and I can see that it's systems that are built on racism that have caused the hardship. And I guess in that it can be pretty overwhelming to both experience that and also try to, you know, walk with people and make ground for people as well, that I meet in my work, against these really big systems and structures that where we're seeing a lot of kind of on a political level at the moment with the rejection of the Uluru Statement of the Heart, for example. You know, like there's these fundamental things that happen right up there, but then you see how they are playing out on the ground in people's everyday lives. Yeah.
Yeah, so when something like that happens, again, we're in the political sphere, aren't we?
Yeah.
With, you know, our leader of the country saying, well, that's not important enough.
Yeah.
What effect does that have on you, I guess, as a practitioner and as a human being?
Well, the image that just came to mind was kind of another shovel of stuff being put on. I don't know, like on the one hand, it makes me more determined. And I guess as the years go on and I read more or talk to other fantastic people and learn different things, I also kind of gather the words and ideas around how to make some impact on that. So it partly makes me more determined. But, yeah, like I said, it's also can be really overwhelming. And I would never kind of underestimate the importance of the support systems that we have as people working in these areas, because unless we have strong support at home and in our broader families and in friendship groups and, you know, amongst colleagues, it can get you down and it can affect your well-being.
Apart from the family support systems around you and friendship groups that you've mentioned, what else is it that you're doing for yourself to keep yourself going?
I think surrounding myself with the right people, with the narrative therapy community in particular, because there's obviously certain politics that go with holding yourself to a narrative philosophy. So I've got access, I think, to some of the most brilliant minds in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm lucky enough to spend 2 weeks in the year in Adelaide with the master's program, where conversations strengthen these ideas, also through laughter and fun, but also through, yeah, like I said, really strengthening those ideas and kind of sharpening those tools, if you know what I mean. That keeps me going. But I guess the motivation at the end of the day is because, you know, my kids, my son's got a year left of high school and, you know, he's hoping to have a career in allied health, and my middle daughter, you know, is talking about being a social worker or a lawyer, and my youngest, luckily enough, just wants to be a unicorn trainer. But but I need to make it possible for my kids, and including my nieces and nephews, to, you know, be able to step into this space and continue the work, but not, you know, not in a way that's still pushing the guna uphill, in a way that it's, they know that it's possible that they can be what they want to be and, yeah, do it in a way that doesn't make them, that doesn't affect their well-being.
So despite the fact that sometimes it feels like another shovel full of stuff has been put on you, it sounds like the narrative therapy community and even just this approach to practice is really filling your cup and strengthening you and surrounding you with the ideas, the skills, the knowledge, and a really supportive environment to be able to carry on.
Absolutely. And like I said before, you know, the stories of the people that I meet in my work, it just keeps me going. I'm so privileged to hear those stories. I'm so privileged to meet the people that I meet. That's certainly a huge motivator as well.
The stories of strength and hope and resilience.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Great. So on that note, tell me a story of strength, hope and resilience, something I guess that's emerged in recent times, a good news story.
I guess if I was thinking of kind of hope and resistance, that there's not just one story, because like I honestly have all these faces going through my mind. There are so many, and whether that's people who have come in and they've said that they're struggling, for example, with addiction, and just kind of that constant holding to the knowing that they've got the skills and knowledge to push away a problem as big as addiction.
Mm.
And like, there's not just one story of that. Like, honestly, every person that I meet, and even if they show that hope and resistance through naming a problem through their own words. For example, there was a lady quite recently who I met, and she'd been diagnosed with anxiety and panic attacks. And I said, you know, do those words fit for you? And she said, well, no, it's when I get pissed off, excuse the language,
yeah, that
this comes about. And so then we kind of explored the name of it, and it was about being pissed off. And like, we had lots of laughs in that. It was a situation of domestic violence, and I think as women, you know, we connected with that. Even that shift of the way that she held on to resistance, that, you know, in this setting of biomedicine and being told by kind of professionals that this is what the problem is, she's saying, no, it's not that. I came away from that kind of going, yeah, you know, feeling really inspired by her story. So, yeah, I think when people name problems for themselves, it's inspiring and hopeful, and there's so many.
Yeah, it just goes to show how important it is in that initial conversation we have with people. How are they sitting with the names or the labels that they've been given by others, particularly in a hospital setting?
Yeah, absolutely.
Standard, isn't it?
And even if people do like those labels, I think to give them an opportunity to say whether they want that label or not is really important. I think it just, you know, these social workers in a really unique position, probably not just in the hospital, in many other realms as well, where I guess we can bring it back to, in a way, balancing that power and, mm-hmm. you know, putting the people we meet at the centre of whatever it is we're doing. And I think, again, it's an opportunity. It's also an obligation and responsibility to continue to do that.
This question is totally left field, but I noticed that one of your hobbies is beekeeping. Now,
Yes. This
has recently become an interest of mine as well, and I'm actually a caretaker of a hive in a community garden. And I think that the organism of the hive is absolutely fascinating.
Absolutely. We have so much to learn from bees.
Yeah. I'm wondering, what is it that draws you to beekeeping, and what have the bees taught you?
Beekeeping's been passed down through my family, through my mum's dad, and, you know, my family continues to be very successful in beekeeping. In terms of what it's taught me and what it teaches me in my work as a social worker, in those times when, and, you know, I've had lots of these times recently, when it all is fairly overwhelming, when I go into the bees, I have no choice but to calm myself because otherwise you get stung. But, you know, I'm on their time, I'm in their space. And so I've learnt these kind of, you know, skills in ways of breathing and humming. I hum to myself when I'm in the bees. I guess it starts with the mind, and then I have to calm my body so that I'm not letting off not calm energy, and then I get stung less. So
I totally know where you're coming from. It's beekeeping is going to be the next self-care for social workers, don't you think?
Absolutely. And then even when you do get stung, I think it's, you know, that reminder of compassion, because that poor bee has seen it as important enough to sting you to protect its people, to sacrifice itself. So the compassion that you have to then feel when you do get stung, I think that's important as well.
Yeah, and what about the sense of community? Because the way I've heard beekeepers talk about bees is they're not individuals. They are a whole organism. And that seems to reflect, I don't know, some sense of what Aboriginal culture represents too, in terms of we're in this together, we are family, and yeah.
Absolutely. And I guess just that, you know, every bee has its certain role. I see some kind of flying over the house and going to this tree that's full of flowers at the moment. But then there's the few that come back and they collect water. So their role is water. yeah, like everybody has their role and it's different, but without each of those roles, the community, you know, would not survive. So there's no hierarchy. I guess it's our human lens that sees the queen as the hierarchy, but she so relies on all the other bees. So.
Mm. And I guess the hive is not without tragedy and trauma as well. We've just got our hive established and we've been really struggling with the combs being built in straight lines, and we've had to sacrifice a couple, which was be really sad from our point of view. And one fell off, and that was like a big drama. But, you know, I've just seen the bees get up, rebuild, refocus, despite us going in there and just causing this huge issue. And I think that teaches us a lot too about, you know, trauma and how we recover from trauma
and doing it together as a community.
Yeah, they're just wonderful creatures, aren't they?
Yeah, sure are.
We could have another whole conversation about them, but we won't. I guess in finishing up, I'd just like to explore with you what your hopes and dreams are for the future. I feel like I've got to know a little bit about what drives you, what your passions are, and how that's linked to the values of social justice particularly. And I'm wondering, as you take these values and principles and ways of being in the world into the future, what does that look like for you?
Yeah, I think something that I will continue to work towards is Aboriginal people working, you know, doing the job that needs to be done. And I think an important part of that is the work that we're doing now to build the capacity. And I just want to say too, Lucy, that this podcast and the ethics that are behind it, I really appreciate that as a step to saying, you know, to privileging the voices of Aboriginal people as well, and privileging the voice of, I guess, the work in an Aboriginal context. Mm. So thank you for that. It's a really important invitation to people. Mm. And I appreciate your doing of that. But I think there should be more Aboriginal social workers coming out, and Torres Strait Islander social workers, and doctors and nurses and anything you want to be. My hopes are to, in hospital settings, for example, to really affect the change, to close the gap and to lower the disadvantage in health outcomes. We have to kind of raise up the voice of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in doing that for our own mob, with our colleagues and, you know, with the support of our allies as well. I'm not at all suggesting that only we have the answers, but we definitely have to make it possible for, you know, there to be more Aboriginal people working at all levels, including having a voice in Parliament.
Hear, hear. Well, thank you very much for your words on the podcast. I guess it's always a challenge as someone who's not Aboriginal to be traversing this space and doing it in a way which is respectful. So I'm always conscious of that. And thank you for saying thank you, I guess, because I'm learning too the whole time. And I just want to offer a space where we can be having this conversation. And, you know, talking about values, reconciliation is one that I've been holding for a long time. And I know that people differ on their opinion on what reconciliation looks like. But to me, it's really about black and white working together. And yeah, how can we find a way of doing that where we can listen to each other and respect each other and hold each other in a really gentle way. So thank you very much again.
And if I can just add that what I appreciate about that is, so they're lovely words and then you're putting it into action. And I think that, you know, that's the important step that people can learn from, is that words are really nice and, you know, words make us feel good, but then what's the action? And so I appreciate your action.
And, you know, we're going to stumble and fall. I probably will, and I'll probably muck up, but that's okay, and that's how I'll learn, and hopefully we can all learn from that together. If we don't go down this way, we'll never know what's possible. So
yeah.
And just in wrapping up, how can people connect with you, either online or in person, if they want to know more about the work that you're doing?
always probably best to start with an email, which is on the Dulwich Centre website, is probably the easiest way to go about that. But, yeah, I'm always happy to connect with people from all over in whatever capacity. So
I did mention in the introduction the book that you co-authored, Aboriginal Narrative Practice, Honouring Storylines of Pride, Strength and Creativity, which is one that's on my bookshelf, and I absolutely love it. Is there any other writings or things that you would like to direct people to that maybe I could put in the show notes for people to follow up on?
As you'd know, Lucy, on the Dulwich Centre website, there's a heap of free readings and also subscription to the journal. I think that that's a good place to start.
Well, thank you very much again for coming on and talking to us. We've covered a whole gamut of things from beekeeping to the political realm of social work. It's been absolutely fabulous, and I'm sure we could have another conversation in the future again. There's just so much more to talk about.
Absolutely, and thank you again.
Thanks for listening to Talk the Walk, the podcast putting legs on social work in Indigenous communities through story. Music by Flashback Digital. You can access all the show notes from today's podcast at www.metaphoricallyspeaking.com.au. I'm currently on the lookout for inspiring interviewees. If you or someone you know is walking the talk in their work or community, then I'd love to hear from you. You can drop me an email at lucy@metaphoricallyspeaking.com.au or visit my contact page on the Metaphorically Speaking website. Until next time, just keep on walking.